I want to remind you before we start that any copy of the full Bible of the Tanakh and or Robert Alter's The David Story are what we're going to be starting on. So the full copy of the Tanakh will have the books of Samuel 1 and 2. Those are the texts we're going to be using, Samuel 1 and 2. So anything you have that has Samuel 1 and 2 in it will be appropriate for this class. Not a Chumash. If you pick up something that says the Chumash, that means it's the five books and sometimes the Haftarot. That won't work. If something says the Torah usually, not always, refers to the five books. That also won't work. We're not doing Genesis through Deuteronomy. We're doing something different. I'll explain just one more time. You can see actually here, you can't see from there, but the Tanakh is the Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. The entire Hebrew Bible is composed of three separate sections. And so there are various books of the Bible, like Job, Ruth, Ecclesiastes, Psalms, Proverbs, Kings, Judges, that are not in the Torah, that are not Genesis through Deuteronomy. We're doing two of those books, Samuel 1 and 2. Also, although I'll repeat this along the way, today you don't need a book. Today I'm just going to give you background. I'll repeat this along the way, but for example, that, hold that up for a second. That will not help you at all. Not at all. Right. Exactly. Unless you exercise it. Then it will be, you're right, then it will be very helpful. So the Eitz Chaim, in other words, the thing you can steal from the sanctuary, won't help you at all. Not you. Won't help you at all, because that has in it small sections for the Haftarot of Samuel 1 and 2, but most of it is, we're doing the story of King David, and that's found in Samuel 1 and 2. As I said, I'm sure I'll repeat this along the way, but the only reason it's called Samuel 1 and 2 is because scrolls couldn't hold the length of the book. It's all one book, but it had to be divided up into two separate scrolls for the purposes of convenience. So really we're doing the book of Samuel, but it's divided up into 1 and 2. Okay? The first 13... What? Where do you purchase Alter's book?
Online.
And it's available in paperback online, and I asked the gift shop to order some. I don't know if they have them or not. Yeah, Don. The Alter book is called The David Story by Robert Alter, A-L-T-E-R, who is a scholar of Bible and literature in general at UC Berkeley, and has translated the Torah with commentary and also translates the book of Samuel with commentary. This is, the David story is Samuel 1 and 2. Even though the first 14, 15-ish chapters of it don't mention David, and that's what I'm gonna give you, bless you, a quick repeat of today. I'm gonna bring us up to chapter 13, where next time we're gonna start our study. That's the paperback of it. You can hold that up. That will help you, although exercise-wise, it's not as effective as the Eitz Chaim. Right. It's about $14 online. Okay. So, but since the class is free, seems only fair. Though you are more than welcome, of course, to make a contribution to the synagogue in appreciation. Okay. So, the book of Samuel starts off after there has been a lot of chaos in Israel. You have to imagine, here's this people that's gradually conquering a new land, and they don't really have any organized system of government. The only thing that's really organized is the religious system, is the priesthood. They have a temple, they have a regular order of priests, they have a hierarchy, but in different areas of Israel, it's run by charismatic leaders, chieftains, basically, where if you are the best warrior and the most drawing individual, the person who has the greatest public presence, you're likely to be the leader. And remember that when I say the greatest warrior, we're talking about very small populations. So literally, if you're better at hand-to-hand combat, that catapult you into a leadership position. These days, we don't think about the world that way, right? We don't think about the world as, oh, well, that person's good at karate, they should be the leader. But in the ancient world, since battle was an essential part of maintaining a community, the greatest fighter was, remember that scene in Indiana Jones where he's cracking his whip and Indiana Jones takes out a gun and shoots him? The ability of, there's a wonderful book by John Keegan called A History of Warfare. He's a British scholar. And he talks about how warfare changes once you can project force, like a bow and arrow, or a slingshot, or more powerfully, obviously, a gun. Because then it has nothing to do with your skill as a warrior. The biggest schlub can kill the greatest warrior if he points a gun at him and shoots. But that's not the world that we're living in with David. We're living in a world where your skill with a sword or a spear, there you can project force, but there it's a physical skill to project force, that determines your social status, okay? So in such a world, the most charismatic chieftain and the most able warrior is the one that's going to succeed in leadership positions. The countervailing force, the other force in society, is religion. And one of the reasons why witch doctors were so powerful is because they could cast spells, which is another form of power. Whether you believe they work or not is irrelevant, but they were believed to work. So that was another form of power, and that's why the two centers of power will be the king and the priest throughout, not just in the Bible, but throughout the Middle Ages until modern times. And in fact, even in modern times, that's true. You remember what Stalin said about the Pope. He said, how many divisions does the Pope have? But the truth is, the Pope has a lot of divisions if he mobilizes them, because he has a role of religious leadership. So you can get a lot done with that kind of power too, and that's the power that rules in Israel. So what happens is, at the opening of the book of Samuel, a woman named Hannah wants a child, and her husband, who's, I think, not the most sensitive husband in the Torah, although the Torah is not noted for sensitive husbands, he says to her basically, you know, why are you so sad? Am I not better to you than any number of sons? Which, you know, you could just imagine her saying, yes, dear, but that's not the point. Yeah. But that's what he says to her. It does not please her or make her stop wanting a son. And in fact, she goes then to the temple and she starts praying to have a child. And what happens is, it says, Eli, who's the high priest, okay? Eli watched her mouth. Now Hannah was praying in her heart. Only her lips moved, but her voice could not be heard. So Eli thought she was drunk. Eli said to her, how long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Sober up. Now, if you assume that the Bible doesn't waste words, it's telling you something about Eli. Right? Here's a guy who sees someone in the temple. He doesn't bother to find out if she's drunk. He assumes she's drunk and yells at her. So this is already a signal that the religious leadership of the temple is not what it should be. And in fact, she prays and she says, if I'm granted a son, I will dedicate him, God, to your service. Okay? And then there's a prayer that I'm not going to bother with at the moment. To make a long story short, she's granted a son. Okay, the son is named Samuel, and she raises him to the age of weaning, whatever that is. In the ancient world, it was older than it is now, right? People wean for a long time. And so finally, she dedicates him to the sanctuary, and in fact, he goes and he becomes Eli's assistant, protege. Wait, I do a whole thing, and then at the end, I take questions. To protege, whatever. So there is a wonderful scene during the. It says, and I'm going to read you the scene because it's such a good one. Young Samuel is in the service of the Lord under Eli. In those days, the word of the Lord was rare; prophecy was not widespread. And the reason that's said is sometimes God's talking all over the place. Sometimes God is quiet. In a time when prophecy is not widespread, people don't understand it very well. Okay. One day, Eli was asleep in his usual place. His eyes had begun to fail and he could barely see. The lamp of God had not yet gone out. In other words, it wasn't that late at night, right? Because the lamp goes out late at night, the wick burns down, whatever it is, or the oil burns out. And Samuel was sleeping in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. I guess they didn't leave the ark alone. And one of Samuel's jobs was to sleep where the ark was, in the same way that when someone dies, you have a shomer. You have somebody who watches over the casket at night. The Lord called out to Samuel, and he answered, "I'm coming." He ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." Because Samuel doesn't know it's God. He hears a voice. Someone says, "Samuel," so he runs to Eli. But he replied, "I didn't call you. Go back to sleep." So he went back and lay down. Again, the Lord called, "Samuel." Samuel rose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am. You called me." But he replied, "I didn't call, my son. Go back to sleep." Now Samuel had not yet experienced the Lord. The word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel again a third time, and he rose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you called me." Samuel is not, he's not a fast learner, Samuel. Then Eli understood that the Lord was calling the boy. At the third repetition, now Eli gets what's going on, and he says, Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down. If you are called again, say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" And Samuel went and lay down. Now this is what happens. The Lord came and stood there and called as before. What "stood there" means, let's leave alone for a moment. Samuel, Samuel. God calls to him twice this time, which only happens a few times in the Torah. It happens to Jacob, happens to Abraham, happens to Samuel. Samuel answered, "Speak, for your servant is listening." The Lord said to Samuel, "I'm going to do in Israel such a thing that both the ears of anyone who hears about it will tingle. In that day I'll fulfill against Eli all I spoke concerning his house from beginning to end. I sentence his house to punishment for the iniquity he knew about, how his sons committed sacrilege. I swear concerning the house of Eli that the iniquity of the house will not be expiated by sacrifice or offering." In other words, God's going to destroy Eli's house and Samuel's going to be the high priest. Now, Eli is his mentor and his teacher. So Samuel lay there until morning. It doesn't say he went back to sleep. It says he lay there until morning. Right, he opened the doors of the house. Samuel was afraid to report the vision to Eli. He doesn't want to tell him what God said. Would you want to tell him what God said? Of course not. But Eli summoned him and said, "Samuel, my son." He answered, "Here." He said, "What did he say to you? Keep nothing from me. This and more may God do to you if you keep a single word of all that he said to you." So he threatens Samuel. "You have to tell me." Now, why does he threaten him? Presumably because Eli understands that now God's talking to this little kid and not to him. So he knows something's going on because he's the high priest, after all, and Samuel's just a little pisher, so to speak. Samuel then told him everything, withholding nothing from him, and Eli said, "He is the Lord. He will do what he deems right." And that's that, okay? And in fact, then subsequently, the house of Eli is decimated, and, well, decimated is not actually, you know what decimated really comes from, that word? It comes from the Romans who killed one out of every 10. It comes from decimal, which like Decalogue, it means 10. That's how you would destroy the army. Rather than killing them all, you'd kill one out of every 10 arbitrarily, and the rest would presumably would surrender. But that's where decimated comes from. Anyway, so he gets rid of Eli's family, and Samuel becomes the high priest. Now Samuel goes through various I don't want to say adventures exactly. Various events happen to Samuel. Samuel's the leader of the people, and he argues against their having a king. And the reason that he argues against it is that you can imagine Israel's supposed to be ruled by God. And a king, first of all, doesn't represent God's will. A priest represents God's will, right? But a king doesn't represent God's will. And that's why later on, kings always talked about the divine right of kings, because they were trying to appropriate the religious authority into the kingship too. That was one of the ways that the kings tried to win out over the church, was to say that the kings are appointed by God. So they have religious and secular authority. But the advantage that the priests had is, by and large, the priests didn't fight wars. And kings who fight wars seem ungodly or less godly than the priest who only does sacrifices. So this was, as I said, this was a constant fight throughout the Middle Ages. If you've ever seen the movie A Man for All Seasons or Beckett, any of these movies about the Middle Ages that show you the struggle between the crown and the priesthood, you know that this was a consistent battle. And by the way, it's not entirely won today. I mean, look at Iran, where there's a clash between the imams and Ahmadinejad, who claims religious authority but is really the secular leader, and the religious claim religious authority but also wish secular power. So it always interpenetrates. Basically, everyone wants everything. So Samuel becomes the leader and argues against the king, but the people continually clamor for a king. And they clamor for a king in part because all the nations around them have kings. And even though we don't like to think of Jews this way, Jews do what other people do. And if you don't believe me, just look at how you're dressed. Mm-hmm. And most of our names. And even the things that we think of sometimes as Jewish aren't in fact Jewish. They're actually traceable to the origin of wherever we came from. The food we eat tends to be regional food. I mean, I don't even know what Jewish food would be. When you ask someone what Jewish food is, they tend to respond to wherever they came from, right? Jewish food in the Middle East is Middle Eastern food, and Jewish food from Eastern Europe is Eastern European food, and Jewish food in Latin America is Latin American food. So Jews saw all the nations around them, and they all had kings. And they wanted a king, too, because a king is a source of pride and so on and so forth. And, you know, if your king is able and strong and so on, it reinforces the national pride and character. The clamor eventually gets too great for Samuel to withstand. And he warns them against it, but the people still want a king, so God acquiesces and decides, okay, they want a king, we'll give them a king. And he goes and he finds a king named Saul. And Saul is a handsome, strapping, powerful guy who was not seeking the kingship. He was not looking to be king. He gets named king. And from the very beginning, there are problems with Saul's kingship, in part because Saul, it seems, is not temperamentally suited to be king of Israel. First of all, it's hard to be the first king because you have a lot of expectations. And sometimes, you know, it's a rare individual that's successful to be at being the first in some position. George Washington, rare individual. Jackie Robinson, rare individual. Saul, not so much. So Saul becomes king of Israel, but he doesn't do very well at it. And he doesn't do very well at it for a couple of reasons. One is, it seems, and I'm going to read you a fascinating and amazing scene, but it seems as though Saul is in some way a kind of bipolar personality. That is, he's gripped with ecstasies and with deep depressions. So for example, and when I promise you can ask any question you want at the end. And when they came there to the hill, Saul saw a band of prophets coming towards him. Thereupon the Spirit of God gripped him, and he spoke in ecstasy among them. When all who knew him previously saw him speaking in ecstasy together with the prophets, the people said to one another, "What's happening to the son of Kish? Is Saul too among the prophets?" And the proverb arose, "Is Saul too among the prophets?" So the biblical scholars will tell you there was this proverb, and then they invented a story to explain it. But the idea is Saul has these fits of ecstasy. He also has these fits of depression, and we know this because one of the stories that you will hear about David is that David is recruited to play music to lift Saul's mood when Saul is in a deep depression, although it says when darkness was on him. It doesn't use the word depression. So Saul had ecstasies, Saul had depressions. This, by the way, is not uncommon in people who are seen historically as very charismatic, right? Somebody who's bipolar, when they're manic, has a certain energy and magic. If you don't think of it now as a psychiatric illness. Think of it as something that God gives you, and you see someone who's manic, it has a tremendous force and power. So when Saul was manic, you could understand why people would think, especially his being a tall person, and height has a very profound effect, certainly still in the modern world, but especially in the ancient world, where, as I told you, being a warrior was what mattered. And here he's got this manic energy, and even gloom gets, even depression gets romanticized in the ancient world. And among the Hasidim, and among Hasidic rabbis, depression was not uncommon, and it was thought of as descending to the depths so that you could raise the sparks that would enable the world to be healed. So what we think of clinically was thought of religiously. And I'm not even going to make an argument that one is better than the other. They're two different ways of seeing the same phenomenon, and in different societies, they worked differently. So you've got Saul with this spirit of mania, and this is what happens to him eventually. So Samuel dies, and the truth is we could read some of this, and here's an example of Saul's inadequacy as a king. He says no one can eat until we win this victory in a certain battle. So Jonathan doesn't know that, and Jonathan being his son, doesn't know that. Jonathan fights heroically, and he takes a certain amount of honey to revive himself. When Saul hears about it, he condemns his son to death. The troops argue and fight, and eventually Jonathan is saved. He does not die. He becomes actually David's best friend, but the fact that Saul was that rigid suggests that there are problems there. Eventually, and I'm trying to decide where we should actually start this, I think I'll probably start with 15, I think that's where we'll start. We'll start with 15 next time, because you need to see Saul's pursuit of David. But the story of Samuel and Saul is, the reason that the book is called Samuel is because Samuel is the beginning of the book, and books are always called by what they start with, or almost always called by what they start with in the Hebrew Bible. The setup is really the setup to a great extent for David, and the setup is, what do you do when you have this division between a priest who has religious power and a king who has secular power? And the king does not always do what God says, because as you will see, one of the reasons why Saul gets rejected by God is because he doesn't kill Agag, who eventually, according to rabbinic tradition, because of his continuation of the line of Amalek, and because Saul doesn't kill him, results in Haman. And since we just finished Purim, this is a good story to tell. But eventually loses the kingship because he's not an adequate king. And so what you need is one leader who can represent everything. And that's what happens, basically. The religious authority gets somewhat downgraded. Samuel is the last high priest that leads the people. From then on, they are, in quotes, secular leaders. I mean, nobody in ancient Israel is really secular, right? They're all religious in one way or another. And what you get then in David is, and this is going to be the story of David, is you get a character who is much more charismatic than Saul, much more able than Saul, much more ruthless than Saul, and is a flawed human being, deeply flawed human being, who does all sorts of stuff that you don't want your leader to do, but at the same time becomes not only a secular figure, but also a religious figure, because David is the progenitor. He's the ancestor of the Messiah. So in David, Israel found, and in Solomon after him, for a brief while, a leader who could represent both religious and secular power. But of course, what we know, looking at it from the perspective of history, is that David couldn't have been, you know, we always assume, let me take a step back and say it this way. We always assume that if we knew great people, we would recognize them. But then you read about how their contemporaries talk about, for example, Lincoln. And some of them thought he was great, and some of them didn't. I remember seeing in Ken Burns' Civil War documentary, which is an amazing piece of work if you've never seen it and you want to know about the history of this country in a riveting way, just order Ken Burns' Civil War. It's really remarkable. It's in, I don't remember, it's in like 10 episodes or something. Anyway, so he's interviewing the great-great-great-granddaughter of the general from the Civil War who started the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan, who was a great general, but was also a racist. He was a Southern general. And so the interviewer says to his great-great-great-granddaughter, a lot of people say that really the only two great men that were produced by the war were your great-great-great-great-grandfather, who was this extraordinary general, and Abraham Lincoln. To which she says, here in the South, we don't think so much of Mr. Lincoln. It was an amazing moment. I thought, my God, 150 years later, we're still, you know, we're still litigating this battle. But if that's true now, you can imagine at his time, and we think of David as being great, but there were several rebellions against him, and it's clear that people had mixed feelings about him at the time. So it depends how you want, if you want to see David through the perspective of the rabbinic lens, then he was the perfect, you know, king and the progenitor of the Messiah. But you'll see as we read the book that he's an extremely complicated character and has all sorts of flaws and fractures in his being. Okay, so that more or less brings us up to date. Next time we'll start with chapter 15 of the first book of Samuel, okay? And we'll read the end of Saul's story and the beginning of David's story, and then we'll move on from there. And you can do it in any translation of the Bible or alters the David story. We can use either one. They're slightly different translations, but that's all to the good. All right, questions? Yes? How does Samuel find Saul? God tells him to find Saul. The same thing with David. Samuel is led by what God says, yeah.
Ishmael's dedication by his mother, does that make him a Nazarite?
Not exactly. Does it make him a Nazarite? Nazarites are people who are promised not to cut their hair, not to drink wine. It doesn't say that explicitly, as it does with Samson. So, yeah.
Two questions. How old was Samuel when he was made high priest and then?
I don't remember. Well, he was never made king.
Well, not king. I mean,
he was never made king. High priest is all he got. Yeah. I don't remember if it gives an age, but it's clearly pretty young. I don't remember.
Because it seemed like
he's young. He's young. But leadership in the ancient world, kings were 16, 17.
Oh.
Right? I don't know if you're aware of this. The kings you read about in the medieval world, they were 16, 17, 18, 19 was already getting old to be a king.
And my second question was why, because David is such a central figure, instead of having two books of Samuel, why don't they have a book of David?
Because that's not the way the Torah works. Oh. There's no book of Moses, right?
Right.
The first word of the first distinctive word generally tends to be, and if not the first major character. So, it's not, and by the way, the end of the second book of Samuel, it's actually the succession battle. So, and that's why Alter calls his book The Story of David, but by convention, that's not the way we name the books of the Torah. Yeah.
What's the argument against God choosing the wrong king?
What's the argument against God choosing the wrong king? In other words, why would God choose the wrong king?
Yeah.
Well, in my discussions, with God on this exact subject. So, here, this is a question that has a lot, has religious, sort of deep religious implications. And here it depends how you think of God and how you think of the Bible. If you came to the Bible for the first time, okay, and you just read through, you would not think of God the way we think of God. If that's all you did was read the Bible, and nobody ever spoke to you about God, as I told you, there is a book that tries to do this, and it does it brilliantly. It won the Pulitzer Prize, in fact, which is rare for a book of religion. It was written by Jack Miles, and it's called God, a Biography. And what he does is he reads through the entire Hebrew Bible. He's a Jesuit priest. He's not Jewish, but he knows a lot about the Jewish tradition too. He reads through the entire Hebrew Bible and he tries to write what God is like purely from the point of view of reading the Bible, as though you knew nothing else but that book. And it's really, it's an excellent book. In fact, as I'm talking about it, it makes me want to reread it because I haven't read it in a long time. It was really good. It's called God, A Biography by Jack Miles, M-I-L-E-S, spelled just like Miles. He did it later with the New Testament, and that got more mixed reviews. But God, A Biography is outstanding. So if you read only the Hebrew Bible, what you would find is that God is a fickle, sometimes mistaken, sometimes arbitrary, often angry or vengeful God who does not in fact react, and often compassionate and wonderful and so on, but I'm only talking about the things we don't normally think of as God's attributes, who does not react the way we would assume. It says that God, at the beginning of the Torah, it says that God regretted that he created human beings. Now the rabbis, of course, explain that away. And they say regret doesn't mean what regret means to you and to me. We use English, or they didn't say English, we use human words to describe something that's essentially non-human, so we use words like regret. But that's only because we don't speak God, right? We only speak person, so we talk about God in ways that human beings can understand. But the Torah itself does not lead us to imagine that God is all-knowing, because again and again, God's schemes fail. God creates the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve sin, and they have to leave. Then there's the Tower of Babel. First of all, there's the flood, which is basically an admission of failure. Why does God have to destroy all the world except for Noah's family, other than it wasn't working right? And God's not supposed to make a world that doesn't work right. Or if human beings are going to mess it up, you would think God would know that. And why would God make them? Just to destroy them. And then God starts with Abraham and says, okay, I'm going to try this group and see if they'll be good. And of course, we're not, right? So again and again and again, God sets up these schemes that don't succeed. And the same thing, as you say, with Saul. Why in the world would God pick a leader that doesn't succeed? And part of the answer that the rabbinic tradition gives, because after all, if you read the book of Judges, you get one inadequate character after another. Samson is a good example. Samson is an adolescent jerk. He really is, if you read the Bible, and that's how the Bible depicts him, as an adolescent jerk. I mean, what leader of Israel, do you know why does Samson tell Delilah what his strength is? That it's in his hair. 99 out of 100 people will say that she seduced him, but she doesn't. She nags him. It's true. She keeps asking and asking and asking and asking until finally he says, get off my back already, it's my hair. He's a child. And by the way, who cuts his hair?
A barber.
Right, not Delilah. It's a barber who cuts his hair. She brings someone in to cut his hair. So the point is that Samson, and so Ed Greenstein, who is a Bible scholar, says basically, so what's going on here? Why is it that Samson is this hero of Israel? And his answer is that again and again and again in leadership, the point of choosing inadequate leaders is that God can use anyone for God's vessel. Anyone. Not just the perfect heroic figure, not just the Moseses of the world, even though Moses isn't perfect either, right? He can't speak. But the point is, God can use these judges who are shmendricks, many of them. You see, if you read the book of Judges, they're not admirable or heroic characters, but God can still use them. The message being, of course, that God can use you too. Right? That's the idea, is that you shouldn't think that only... Now, sometimes God seeks to use someone and they don't live up to what it is that God wants to use of them. So maybe you would say Saul was a necessary transitional figure in order to get to David. I mean, you can make reasons why God picked Saul, but if you look at the Torah itself, it does seem as though God, you know, is floundering around for the right scheme. So, yes. David is a significant figure for three reasons. One, because he was the king that unified Israel north and south, and it only stayed unified under David and Solomon. It was very brief. Four reasons. Two, he eliminated the major threat to Israel, which was the Philistines. Three, he is regarded by tradition as the ancestor of the Messiah. Which is why, by the way, the New Testament opens with a long genealogy seeking to connect Jesus to David, because you can't be the Messiah of Israel unless you come from the house of David. And four, I'm writing a book about David. Those are the four reasons. Yeah.
So at the end of the Samuel Eli episode, at least in my translation, there's this passage, and Samuel grew in the waters with him and let none of his words fall to the ground.
Yeah.
No,
it's and where that's say the chapter and verse.
It's chapter 3, verse 19.
So my guess is before I look and see what Alter has to say that just means none of them went to waste. But I'll tell you if Alter has a comment about that. He let not fall to the ground any of his words. The antecedent of his is ambiguous. But since the point in the narrative report is to confirm Samuel's prophetic authority, the more likely reading is God didn't allow any of Samuel's words to go awry, but fulfilled all of his prophet's predictions. Right? It's like didn't let any words go to waste. The same idea. Yeah. So, yes, Jerry.
I've always thought that the Kohen was basically a lineal group. Literally,
Well,
I'm
assuming that Samuel is a Kohen, I would guess, right? Because Eli is just the high priest. He's not the only Kohen. There are a lot of Kohanim. So I'm assuming if he served in the temple, that Hannah would only dedicate him to the temple if he was a Kohen. That would be my guess. Yeah.
I think his father, Elkanah,
I'll check. Yeah.
Wouldn't the question of why God chose imperfect vehicles be ultimately bound to the question of free will and determinism?
Yes, it would be. The problem, the issue with that, about why does God choose imperfect vehicles is free will and determinism, and that's often the answer that's given. But even so, you would think that God would be able to foresee that this path would lead to disaster. So choose someone else. Right, especially when it comes to Noah and the world. Couldn't God foresee that the entire world would go awry? That's the answer that usually, it's one of the answers that the rabbis give.
God can correct it later. Then.
Yes, but he can't, plan so well before. Yeah. Well, there's a difference between perfect and inadequate, right? Things can be good enough. Some leaders were good enough, but Saul, the generation of Noah, they were terrible in some sense. So it depends. I don't think that we expect perfection from any of the characters of the Torah, but some of them are better, some worse. So, yeah. You'll read about David's ancestors. I'm going to not answer questions about David specifically because we're going to get to David over the course of the next probably 3 years. Yeah. I'm just guessing.
Peripheral question. As I imagine Saul being selected for his physical qualities, I'm trying to have a picture in my mind of what he's like. How did David's physical qualities...
I'm not going to answer questions about David because we're going to get to David over the next couple of years. Right. Yeah. And you'll read something about that explicitly. I'm sure that that's true. By the way, just in the interest of getting Lord Acton, that's the way people always quote it, but what Acton said is power tends to corrupt, and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. And the reason that he put it that way is he was a political theorist, an English political theorist, is that it doesn't always corrupt, is that people there have been powerful people who've been uncorrupted. I mean, a very good example is Washington, who could have been king of America and chose not to be. It is certainly true that you see that over and over again in the Torah, and it especially happens when Solomon's kids can't agree on the north and the south, and the kingdom splits apart. And one of the lessons of the Torah, I think, and one of the lessons of the rabbinic tradition, is that's true of all forms of power. It's not only true of political power, it's true of religious power too. That also tends to corrupt. And it's very easy to be, it's very easy in any position of influence. It was such an interesting study that showed that as people rise in an organization, when they test them, their level of empathy for those below them diminishes. So you care a lot about the secretary when you're a secretary. When you're the boss, you tend to care less. And that's a normal human reaction against which human beings have to fight in order to be different. Because one of the great things about psychological laws in human beings is knowing them, you can violate them, right? I remember that was one of the few things that I remember from my psychology class in college was the psychology teacher made this amazing point. He said, we know from psychological testing that if someone's in trouble, the more people that are around, the less likely any individual is to help. If there are two or three people there, you're going to help. But if there are 100 people there, you say, someone will get it, right? He said, but the great thing about human beings is now knowing that rule, you can violate it. Now, next time you're around, someone's in trouble and there are 100 people there, you can say, geez, I know that people are unlikely to help because there are so many around, so I'm going to go help, which is a great thing, yeah. Yes, God could have stepped in a little more. And the degree to which God intervenes or doesn't intervene is a continual religious question in every situation. Look, I'll give you, as I've said before, I'll give you the Baal Shem Tov's answer. When people ask why God doesn't intervene, he said, think about it as when you're teaching your child to walk. He said, when you first teach your child to walk, you're right there next to them. You hold them up. You let them take steps. He says, but gradually you move further and further and further away so that they learn how to walk to you. He said, and God does the same thing with human beings. Gradually, God moves further and further and further away so that human beings learn how to walk to God. So that's an answer. Don't know what the answer is. And just know that fundamental theological questions, they come up all the time when you're reading the Torah. It doesn't, you know. But anyway, yes. No? Oh, yeah.
High priests. What is the current version of a high priest?
We don't have one because we don't have a temple.
They were
either lineage or God. Right. Well, it was, here's what I assume happened. What goes on in the temple is this highly specialized, ritualized thing, right? Just read the book of Leviticus if you can. It's not an easy book to read because it's all about the sacrifice and you sprinkle the blood here and you sprinkle the blood there. It's like a manual, basically, for priests. So what goes on in the temple is very highly specialized. It's almost like, what goes on in, let's say, I don't know, a bank or a software company where most people have no idea what they're doing in there as long as it works. So for most of Israel, as long as when you came to the temple, your animal got slaughtered and your blood got sprinkled and your prayers got said and you felt forgiven, that's all you needed. You didn't need to know how they picked the priests in there. The priests worried about who picked the priests. And that's what happened, is it was internal, just always, I hesitate to make this comparison, but it's kind of like the Vatican. right? It's like, as long as it continued to work. So what happened with Samuel and God and so on, this is how the Bible depicts it. If you wanted to write an alternative version about how Samuel managed to become the high priest and take the leadership away from the house of Eli, you could probably write a pretty neat novel about that that has nothing to do with, you know, God deciding, but has more to do with Samuel was obviously very savvy and became the leader of Israel. So... the way that the temple worked was, there was a Kohen Gadol, which we call a high priest, okay? He was supported by the vast substructure of the priesthood. But he was the one who went into the Kadosh Kadoshim, the Holy of Holies, each year on Yom Kippur, and would say the prayers, and no one else was allowed in there, right? So much so, by the way, that they tied a rope around his leg. Because should he faint, should he die in there, no one could go in there to get him, you had to pull him out. That's how much they took it seriously that you don't go in where the Ark of God is. And if you don't know why, just watch, you know, Indiana Jones. Very, very dangerous to go near the Ark. So the, and there's a story, you know, in the Torah of someone touching the Ark and dying as a result of it. But that's a separate issue. Anyway, so it was supported by this vast substructure and was supposed to be lineal. The high priesthood was sometimes contested too. There were people who supported this one for the high priest or people who supported that one for the high priest, unsurprisingly. And they were supposed to run the religious life of the society and run the temple. And the king was separate. And that's the way it was supposed to work. And for some of Jewish history, it seemed to have worked that way. So, yeah, I'll go across.
In chapter one, the story of talks about the doorpost of the temple. Is this the moving tabernacle? Because the temple hasn't been built yet, right?
It's partly the tabernacle. It's the shrine that served as the temple before a temple was built, right? They had a sort of a makeshift temple, so to speak, in which the Mishkan from the wilderness served as the centerpiece. And then Solomon finally builds the real temple for God.
Was that in Shiloh?
Yeah, it was in Shiloh. It wasn't in Jerusalem. Jerusalem comes with David.
When in the timeline, where are we in relation to when the Jews entered Israel?
So probably this is, let's say the Jews entered Israel, there's a lot of debate about this, 1300 BCE. This is probably 1050 BCE, a couple hundred years later, because around 1000 usually is considered the time of David and Solomon.
What's the population?
Small. Very, I mean, you'll see reading it what it is. Well, that's something that we'll develop over the course of reading the book, but it's very hard to know. Very hard to know. We don't know, for example, there are lots of things we would love to know, but there's no way to know. How much of the population was literate? How many of them ever saw a high priest? How scattered were they? How many of the tribes that we read about got assimilated into the Jewish people? How many of them were wiped out? I mean, there are so many questions that we don't have enough. And think how little survives from, we're talking 3,000 years ago. If you get an inscription, you're lucky. And then you draw all sorts of conclusions from the inscription, but you don't really know if that's true. Yeah.
Is our study of David going to finish and coincide with the completion of your book?
No, I have no idea. I tend to doubt it, but I'm not planning one way or the other. We're just studying David because it's a fascinating story. I don't know how fast we'll go, and I don't know how quickly the book will be done. But I think that my guess is that it will long outlast the completion of the book. That's my guess, but I don't know for sure. So, yeah. There's no relation at all between a rabbi and a Kohen. None at all. A Kohen can become a rabbi, and a non-Kohen can become a rabbi. The rabbinic tradition didn't begin till long after the time we're studying. There are no rabbis in the time of David. There's no such thing as a rabbi. There are no doubt religiously learned people, but there's no rabbis. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The role of the Levites, then, in, I
right.
supporting the Kohanim.
Right, exactly what they do. The Levites also support this. They're the second tier of staff that support the ritual in the temple. But as you will see, there are also the other religious aristocracy are the prophets that we just heard about. And there were apparently bands of prophets, not individual prophets, but bands of prophets whose profession it was to prophesy. That's what they did. They wandered around the countryside and they prophesied and they told you what was going to happen in the future and what God wanted and all of that sort of stuff. And that was their job. And presumably some did it better and some did it worse. Last question. Yeah?
How is that different from fortune telling? How did these prophets know that they were prophets and not fortune tellers?
Well, they were. It depends what you mean by fortune tellers. Soothsayers and fortune tellers were actually outlawed, as you will see. You'll find out about that later. Because fortune telling is magic. Prophecy is religious. This is what God tells you to tell the people. And the prophets were those who, and by the way, the Torah talks about how you tell a false prophet, and it's a big issue in the times of the Torah. But prophets were those who believed that God told them this is what will happen to the people, right? That was not, and the difference, by the way, James Frazier talks about this, the guy who wrote The Golden Bough. The difference between magic and prophecy, or magic and religion, is in part magic doesn't create communities. Religions create communities. Magic doesn't create communities. I mean, you may have a group of magicians, but you don't create a community. Religion does. So it's partly a communal issue. I mean, you may go by magic, I don't mean like professional magicians who do tricks. I'm talking about, you know, a witch, so on. Although I suppose there are covens these days. Right, but apart from on the college campus, witches don't create communities. And also because prophecy was not supposed to be for your individual benefit, right? Prophecy was by and large about the people and what God wanted of you and so on. It wasn't usually to give money to the prophets. It was, you know, mitzvot, so on, as we read when we read the prophets. Okay, so next time we'll start with the first book of Samuel, chapter 15, and please rise.